from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. Love, you've got the power,
but you can't. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is a packed hour ahead. I won't have time for calls because I'm going to devote a double segment to my guest, Sybil Edmonds. Haven't heard of her? Most people have not. But you will hear about information concerning 9/11 that will shock you. You will hear it in a way that is compelling because the Sybil, the woman who has uncovered it, was tormented. She was put through the worst of conditions by the FBI because they didn't want this information to come out. In fact, no one wanted this information to come out. Well, we'll bring it all out, put it before you, and you decide how important it is. So she is a former FBI translator. She gained notoriety having exposed illicit activities within the FBI involving security breaches, intelligence neglect about pre-9/11 communications, notifying of a massive attack on American cities, cover-ups, and international blocking of intelligence that endangered American security. And that's where we begin her conversation. Also today, I'm going to share, as much as time permits, of the speaking truth to all the powerful lobbyists who are trying to make it seem like hydrofracking for gas is a good thing, brings jobs, is safe, not a problem for the environment. They lie. First, you'll have the actual part of the documentary, just about maybe 6 or 7 minutes. Then a short commentary from Abraham Lustgarten from ProPublica on injecting wells, the poison beneath us. Wow, some really powerful information. Continuing our push against the GMO companies and the control they have over the legislative process, real specific why GMOs are bad and the science to back it up. From the environmental movement, the seas are rising faster than ever before, and specifically on the East Coast around New York and Boston and Washington. What does this mean? A commentary, What is Left of the Country, by Chris Hedges, and also I Don't Want to Conquer the World by Timothy Gatto from Countercurrents. We always start with the latest on health and healing. Let's begin. Many people ask me, why do I have a low testosterone? I'm losing muscle mass and energy, libido, interest in things that used to inspire me. What can I do, Gary? The first thing I suggest is they get two studies, simple, inexpensive. One is to determine the total testosterone, but then a larger hormone profile, like DHEA, the master hormone from which others are made. And I also want to know about adrenaline and thyroid. All these are interconnected. But a new study from the Endocrine Society's annual meeting just yesterday in Houston said the following, quote, declining testosterone levels are not an inevitable part of the aging process, as many people think. This is according to Dr. Wittert, the professor of medicine at the University of Adelaide, in Australia, quote, testosterone changes are largely explained by smoking behavior and changes in health status, particularly obesity and depression, end quote. They gave no suggestions of how to reverse it. All they said was that it's not universal. Here's what they could have found out. That yes, you can reverse testosterone level in men and women. And by the way, when women increase their testosterone level, their libido spikes. That's why some women, that we saw a very high percentage in a women's health support group, who had measured their hormone levels prior to entering and post the one-year program, there were 257 women in it, at the beginning, 97% said their libido after menopause was almost non-existent. or there was physical symptoms of pain because of thinning of the mucous membranes in the vagina, and because of lack of energy, because of depression, all these things coming, just hitting you one after another in many, but not all, postmenopausal women. So we simply decided, in men and women, we had a concomitant group of men who had andropause, which is the male form of menopause. Can we reverse this naturally? Here's what we found. The best way to rebalance your testosterone, specifically free testosterone, is start exercising 6 days a week for 1 hour aerobically, and resistance exercise 5 days a week for a half hour. Then the elimination of all alcohol, which really throws your hormone levels out of balance. And start with the green juices. Our suggestion is 6 to 8 glasses of fresh green juices a day. Now, you can combine apple and those green juices. Even grapefruit is very good as well. Then muraupuama is very important. Oat straw is important in men and women. Dong Quai in the women, and very, very good, as well as squall vine and Vitex. In the men, we found that giving a man in the late afternoon, early evening, 5-hydroxytryptophan along with melatonin made all the difference, because when men are not getting a full night's restful sleep, a deep sleep, uninterrupted because of enlarged prostate, frequent urination, lights on, noise, then that will affect testosterone levels. But between those simple things, none of which are that complicated, they were able to return their free testosterone by actual examination of the blood to very high levels, the kind of levels a 58-year-old woman had that she had when she was in her 30s. So that's the other part of this. So when they say not all men have deficiency of testosterone, they haven't factored in how many of those men did they interview who were exercising. They're just looking at smoking. Well, an awful lot of men don't smoke, have low testosterone. And we find that low testosterone leads to depression. And hence, if you reverse the low testosterone, you frequently reverse the depression. Now, from the environment, this came out yesterday. This is from the climate impact research at the Potsdam Institute, and it says, significant sea level rise in a 2-degree warming world. Now, we're past 2 degrees, by the way. We're on our way to 3 degrees. Quote, sea levels around the world can be expected to rise by several meters if global warming carries on. And then it goes on to talk about the fact that you don't have a uniform rise everywhere. And the reason that the seas rise is simple. You have two primary explanations. One is the melting of the major glaciers and ice packs that are 2 miles deep and about 3 times the size of Texas on Greenland. And it's melting much more rapidly than what anyone had ever predicted. And there's gigantic waterfalls. I mean, they look like a Niagara Falls. And there are thousands of these all over Greenland, especially in the warm weather. And that then goes to the bottom, and then all that water going to the bottom on the rocks creates a whole skid effect. It's like you put some oil down and you're moving something. And the whole glaciers are going towards the ocean at a much more rapid rate. So when you look at the outside of a glacier, giant block of ice that's right at the edge, and you see it calve or break off, that's minor compared to the breaking off underneath the water that no one had paid attention to. In my new documentary, you'll see all this. You'll see cavities that are gigantic underneath the ice that you can't see from the sea. You have to go underneath. And little tiny, I mean tiny, when I say tiny, I'm tiny, tiny. Big enough for just one person with a camera to go underneath and film up in there. And you just hope that that damn ice doesn't break, because if it does and it hits you, it's over. But it's exciting and it's interesting, and you get to see some really wonderful things happening. But walking up, and you can't get too close because it's just slippery, and you just slip right into that whole crevasse, and you go down 2 miles, you're dead. In any case, you have to get with spike shoes on, and you have to have a security line. But then you start to film, and you put your camera on a long extension pole, a makeshift one, one that they actually cut bamboo, or they cut palms, gets you about 20 feet. You get over 20 feet, and you look down. It absolutely looks and sounds like a gigantic waterfall. Never thought of those before. And suddenly in the summertime, you'll see thousands upon thousands of little lakes, 100 yards across, 2 or 3 miles across, 10 to 12 feet deep. Where's all the water go? Creates cracks, goes right through. So all the rules, all the math, all the mathematical and computer models about melting, they're all wrong. All of them. There's not one single accurate prediction in the world. And that's one of the things I found in interviewing scientists after scientists. We're in chaos theory. Then you have the great Himalayan range, and you have all of that melting, and it's melting faster. When you see a village, and a man goes from where he lived, which would have been 100 yards, to the ponds, so his stock of yak or sheep can water horses, and now he has to go 1.5 miles. And that's all in 3 years, faster than what anyone thought it would happen. Then Antarctica, same thing. You have 2 glaciers in Antarctica, the size of Spain and Greece combined, and they're melting. Actually, one's as large as France and Spain. That's big. So that means that in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Boston, you're going to have worse storm surges. You're going to lose your beaches in the sand. That's inevitable, because every time a storm comes in, the further a storm surge, the water comes in, and when it goes back out, every time that wave goes out, it's taking sand with it. You would never be able to resupply the sand that is taken away from just one storm season. It would cost tens of millions of dollars per beach. And yet, that's what people are faced with. And then it's going to go into the water supply, the wells. Now, that's salt water. So you're going to have salt water going into areas. And you don't think it's big? 1 foot sea rise will take away 100 to 200 feet of land. Now, imagine how far, when that foot rises and comes up the Hudson River and around Manhattan, how far does it have to go under 100 feet to put the subways in the flooding position? So mark my words, in the next 2 to 3 years, 5 years, you're going to see the subways in lower Manhattan having regular flooding problems. Something to deal with now, not then. From Medical News Today, from PLOS Medicine, a major peer-reviewed journal, here's the latest. Soda marketing campaigns undermine public health. I'll quote this. It's rare that you get mainstream media saying anything like this, medical media. In this week's major scientific publication, Big Food, U.S. experts call for health advocates to launch strong public health campaigns to educate policymakers and the public regarding the dangers of sugary beverages and to clarify the fact that industry corporate social responsibility campaigns are misleading and distract from their products' healthy risks. The authors, the media, and the public health experts from Berkeley and Boston evaluated famous campaigns from industry leaders like Pepsi and Coca-Cola in a policy forum article, which according to their opinion interprets corporate social responsibility as elaborate, expensive, and multinational campaigns. So what this means is no different when the tobacco industry was forced to do some socially conscious work to inform you that all these end up just being PR campaigns. So almost everything you see about caffeine, sugar, or anything else, they're all going to be helping the industry and give them a clean bill of health instead of showing you the truth. So exactly how are we supposed to educate our legislators when they're already in the pocket of ALEC? We can't. We just have to throw them out of office. That will take a while. The good news, I've been in contact with all the third-party candidates and all the previous presidential candidates and major people out there who have good, sound policies, populist policies, it'll take one more election cycle before you have a really good people's program. But it's coming. That's with a lot of people supporting it. From the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Diabetes, as published in Science Daily, this is good. Pasta made from green banana flour, a tasty alternative for gluten-free diets. I'll quote this. People with celiac disease struggle with limited food choices as their condition makes them unable to tolerate gluten found in wheat and other grains. Researchers from the University of Brazil have developed a gluten-free pasta product from green banana flour, which tasters found more acceptable than regular whole wheat pasta. The product has less fat and is cheaper to produce than standard pastas. Quote, there is no significant difference between the modified pasta and standard samples in terms of appearance, aroma, flavor, and overall quality. And that was from the Department of Nutrition, University of Brazil. Green bananas are considered a subproduct of low commercial value with little industrial use. For banana growers and pasta makers, there is the possibility of diversifying and expanding their market. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to order some of this. I'll get a bunch in, and I'll make a big batch, and then I'll have people come by and give them some free samples, and if it tastes good and it's good for you, I've already done the nutritional profile on it, then we should start asking all of our health food stores and food co-ops to order it in. And then all those home-based business people out there and people creating your own products from your home, good for you, now you have something that can compete in the marketplace in a good way. So I see only good coming from this. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. One final note on stress, and this is important. This is from Stanford University School of Medicine, and it says the following, how stress can boost immune system. A study spearheaded by Stanford University School of Medicine scientists has tracked the trajectories of key immune cells in response to short-term stress and traced in great detail how hormones triggered by such stress enhance immune readiness. The study conducted adds weight to evidence that immune responsiveness is heightened rather than suppressed, as many believe, by the so-called fight-or-flight response. They're absolutely correct, which means in lay language that initially when we're really hyped, we'll have our whole immune system come forward. But just imagine this. Imagine you're sleeping in the woods, and suddenly you hear something. Your vision increases, your strength, your sense of smell, your muscle contraction is tight, and you're ready to fight. You're ready to flee. Your whole immune system is up. Your digestion stops. That lasts for about 2 minutes. Found that out when I was doing some racing in the 1980s. And I would go out like a bullet and then just get totally fatigued. And then I realized, what am I thinking? And I was thinking about, am I going to make that 455 mile, the first mile, the second mile, 505? And I was stressed. So I went through a simple exercise. And I went into a flotation tank. There were a few around New York at the time. And you were going to an isolation tank, and you're floating in salt water, and it's dark, and it's very, it reminds, at a limbic level, it reminds you of being back in the womb. And then you put into your mind a tape. I will run relaxed. I will run at ease. I will run at peace. I will not be stressed. I will not be tense. And you repeat that over and over again. And the very next race, it was just as if it was effortless running. So de-stressing yourself then not only allows an immune response, but it holds in reserve that fight-or-flight response to when you really need it. But keep it up, and the absolute opposite will happen. You will depress your immune system after you have initially energized it. I'm Gary Noll. We're here to talk about issues that make a difference in our lives. Now, we're going to play a very short piece, about 5 minutes, of a new challenge to the gas hydrofracking industry. And this is a wake-up call for our governor, Governor Cuomo. With respect, call him today and say, Governor Cuomo, we have irrefutable proof from a large group of scientists, including environmental scientists, that can convince you or anyone that gas hydrofracking anywhere would be dangerous to human health and the environment and would indeed lead inevitably to the pollution of our pristine water in New York. Now, you won't recognize all the people, but one of the people that you're going to hear from is the former head of Homeland Security, who was also governor of Pennsylvania, who then was given $900,000 to go out and become the shill, the front lobbyist for the gas hydrofracking industry. Tom Ridge is his name. Compare that with a scientist, a PhD professor, who is showing you, if you don't understand because you're not seeing it, and about a minute into, that he's explaining that the protection around the wells, the casings, the metal casings, they all get infiltrated. There's no such thing as a permanent casing, which means that every single well that's drilled, every single well inevitably will corrode, or the toxic gas will get into it, which means it gets into the water supply. All right? That's because you wouldn't know who you're listening to. Now a few minutes of this, and then back, and I'll give you the governor's number. I'll give you a few more statements on injecting wells, the poison beneath us that you didn't know about. Please stay with us.
Governor Andrew Cuomo has stated that he will let science, not emotion, guide his decision on whether or not to let the gas industry frack in New York State. With a gas-bearing Marcellus Shale formation underlying 50% of the state, and with the gas industry proposing upwards of 100,000 gas wells, his decision could fundamentally transform New York.
Please welcome Tom Ridge.
You are the former governor of the great state of Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, first Secretary of Homeland Security. Now, you're a lobbyist for the natural gas industry. We have all seen the footage of flaming water. Whoa. Is that really happening to people's water supplies, sir?
Out here is the rock. We're looking in a cross-section of a well that's being drilled. Because ultimately, you want your gas to come up the steel pipe. That inch right there, this is cement. And what you don't want is for that cement to fail or to be absent, to crack, to corrode, to crumble, to disappear, if what's down there can get into this annulus. Then it can migrate.
Yes, it is happening to some water supplies, and it has absolutely nothing to do with hydraulic fracking. Methane gas is naturally occurring. They've had methane gas, I'm speaking as a governor, in some of our water wells in Pennsylvania long before any wells, fracked wells, were located next to them.
Those are phenomena that are very well known for as long as we've been drilling wells and casing them.
Naturally occurring methane gas often ends up in water wells, but there has not been a single proven instance where it has been related to hydraulic fracking.
So now the shallow gas goes into an open annulus, pressurizes the annulus, gas migrates into an underground source of drinking water, somebody's water well.
Gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing is an inherently contaminating industrial process that injects millions of gallons of water laced with toxic chemicals at enormous pressure to break apart rock and release gas from underground formations. Watersheds across the nation have been contaminated with plastics, carcinogens, neurotoxins, and endocrine-disrupting chemicals, and with explosive natural gas.
Whoa!
It causes massive land scarring, air pollution, a public health crisis, truck traffic, miles and miles of pipelines, blowouts, spills, accidents. It is a whole-scale industrialization. I released Gasland in June of 2010. One day that month, I got an email. It was from the New York Times. A document called Debunking Gasland, a long list of points which the gas industry had made against my film. Their chief point was that the shot seen around the world from Gasland of Mike Markham lighting his water on fire,
whoa,
was somehow a fake, not due to drilling, that the methane in his water well was quote-unquote naturally occurring. Was anybody buying it? I happened to be in Pittsburgh right around this time and luckily was able to sit down with Doug Shields, the leader of city council, who was able to pass a ban on hydrofracking throughout the city.
Want the computer on to make it look like actually a worker?
Okay.
Pittsburgh's public drinking water supply had been shut down by gas drilling waste getting to the Monongahela River just a year earlier.
They allowed them to just go dump the stuff in the river.
They're literally taking the waste product with all those chemicals, all those volatile organics,
radionuclides, all this other stuff, into the river.
Directly into the drinking water.
Directly into the drinking water supply with a minimal of treatment. The inference being, well, we sent it to a treatment plant, and the inference to the public is somehow this water is being made whole again, and all the bad things are removed, and that's simply not true.
The New York Times put star investigator Ian Urbina on the case. Their investigation uncovered thousands of internal documents showing that radioactive wastewater and harmful carcinogens such as benzene were being inadequately treated and put back into drinking water supplies all over Pennsylvania. But Doug explained to me that this isn't always the way journalism works.
You know, they're coming in and telling me the sky is pink all day, that it's pink.
So he told me, most of the journalism out there isn't investigative journalism. It's what you call he said, she said journalism. So if someone's in the room with the media and the person says, the sky is blue, then the media report that day is the sky is blue. But if someone comes in at the last minute and says, no, wait, the sky is actually pink, well, then the media report that day is going to be the facts are being debated.
It isn't blue. It's really pink. And if you leave that on the table and don't rebut that, then the sky's pink. And that is what the oil and gas industry has done. And the sky is pink in Harrisburg. We've seen the movie. We've saw tobacco companies sit in front of microphones and perjure themselves in front of the United States Congress, fine, upstanding citizens with money, corporate executives saying, I do not believe tobacco causes cancer. And meanwhile, the memo is back in their drawer that says otherwise.
In the 50s, Hill & Knowlton PR firm designed the strategy to dispel that nasty little rumor that tobacco caused lung cancer, misinformation, and supporting bogus science that would call into doubt the legitimate science. The American Natural Gas Association hired Hill & Knowlton in 2009 as their PR firm. All of a sudden, ads were everywhere. They even bought my name on Google. Naomi Oreskes, author of the book Merchants of Doubt, traced disinformation campaigns from big tobacco all the way up to climate change.
When I opened your book, I saw Hill & Knowlton is the author of this strategy for tobacco, and Hill & Knowlton was hired by the American Natural Gas Association.
Oh, so there it is. So 60 years later, right, we have the same PR firm that actually invented, John Hill was the originator of this whole strategy. So there they are still doing the same thing again 50, 60 years later.
Wow.
Wow. It's depressing, isn't it? If we say, you know, oh, yes, oil and gas come out of people's taps naturally, you know, a lot of people just don't know. They think, oh, really? Is that true? You know, oh, well, I've heard people say that in Santa Barbara the tap water smells bad, you know, so maybe it's true. Okay, now we have a debate, right? An ordinary person who doesn't know what to think doesn't need to think that I'm right. They just need to think that there's a debate, because so long as there's a debate, then there's an argument for staving off regulation. Science that really shows that these claims that you're talking about are preposterous. I mean, how do we know that climate change is real? How do we know that tobacco kills people? How do we know that acid rain is caused by burning coal in power plants in the Midwest? How do we know that oil and gas doesn't normally come out of your tap? Well, the answer is we know through scientific studies and scientific understanding.
It's just like the tobacco industry had memos in their drawers. It said all along that they knew that nicotine was addictive and tobacco was harmful. The gas industry has memos in their drawers. We have some of them. Some of them, in fact, have been published. Others fell off the back of the truck, but here they are, and they'll show you.
That's just a little piece of pushback more on another show. Also from ProPublica, this is called Injection Wells, The Poison Beneath Us, from Abraham Lustgarten. Over the past several decades, U.S. industries have injected more than 30 trillion gallons of toxic liquid deep into the earth, using broad expanses of the nation's geology as an invisible dumping ground. No company would be allowed to pour such dangerous chemicals into the rivers or onto the soil. But until recently, scientists and environmental officials had assumed that deep layers of rock beneath the earth would safely entomb the waste for millennia. There are growing signs they were mistaken. Records from disparate corners of the United States show that wells drilled to bury this waste deep beneath the ground have repeatedly leaked, sending dangerous chemicals and waste gurgling to the surface or on occasion seeping into shallow aquifers that store a significant portion of the nation's drinking water. In 2010, contaminants from such a well bubbled up in a West Los Angeles dog park. Within the past 3 years, similar fountains of oil and gas drilling waste have appeared in Oklahoma and Louisiana. In South Florida, 20 of the nation's most stringently regulated disposal wells failed in the early 1990s, releasing partly treated sewage into aquifers that may one day be needed to supply Miami's drinking water. Scientists and federal regulators acknowledge that they do not know how many of the sites are leaking. There are more than 680,000 underground waste and injection wells nationwide, more than 150,000 of which shoot industrial fluids thousands of feet below the surface. Scientists and federal regulators acknowledge they do not know how many of these sites are leaking. Federal officials and many geologists insist that the risks posed by all this dumping is minimal. Accidents are uncommon, they say, and groundwater reserves from which most Americans get their drinking water remain safe and far exceed any plausible threat posed by injecting toxic chemicals into these wells. But in interviews, several key experts acknowledge that the idea that injection is safe rests on science that has not kept pace with reality, and oversight simply doesn't work. Quote, in 10 to 100 years, we are going to find that most of our groundwater is polluted, said Mario Salazar, an engineer who worked for 25 years as a techno expert at the EPA's underground injection program in Washington. Quote, a lot of people are going to get sick, and a lot of people may die, end quote. And finally, the boom in oil and natural gas drilling is deepening the uncertainties geologists acknowledge. Drilling produces copious amounts of waste, burdening regulators and demanding hundreds of additional disposal wells. Those wells, more holes punched in the ground, are changing the Earth's geology, adding man-made fractures that allow water and waste to flow more freely. There is no certainty that any of this is, and whoever tells you the opposite is not telling you the truth, is safe. You have changed the system with pressure and temperature and fracturing, so you do not know how it will behave. And I commend ProPublica good work on this. They took a look and found case histories and government summaries of more than 220,000 well inspections and found that structural failures inside injection wells was routine and regular. So they had more than 17,000 violations of wells that were expected. So what does that tell you the next time you hear one of these people from the hydrofracking industry saying it's safe? It is not. We have tons of information that we can supply. We have experts. We have people who are knowledgeable. So we're asking Governor Cuomo today, please, Governor Cuomo, do the right thing. Actually, set aside political interest, set aside economic interest, and just listen to the people of New York. We don't want gas hydrofracking. We don't need it. It'll only be a disaster. So do the right thing. Don't allow it. And while you're at it, how about closing down, once and for all, Indian Point? You don't want to be the guy who protected them, protected the corporate interest, did that little political two-step that you all do up there in that little cesspool of Albany, and then when the big problems come, say, I didn't know. Well, you knew. We reminded you. Close down Indian Point. Stop gas hydrofracking in New York. Call and remind the governor politely. Call and remind him. Email him. You can email him at governor.ny.gov/contact the governor. That's governor.ny.gov/contact the governor. His phone number. And I suggest everyone in this audience call him and remind him. This is our state. We pay taxes on it. This is our water. It's what we have. Don't allow these stupid little vulgar lobbyists. Don't allow these people who will sell you anything and just put money into politicians' pockets. Don't let that stand between you making the right choice. We will appreciate your actions if your actions support New York. If you go against us, I can promise you there will be millions of people who will know you sold out. Understand this, we are not any longer going to allow our state, our resources, to be exploited by those who do so for financial or political gain. So do the right thing. 518-474-8390. 518-474-8390. Be polite and courteous when you call. Let us hope that he does the right thing. Let's anticipate he does until we find that he doesn't. If he doesn't, then we'll have a demonstration out there in front of the governor's office that we did in New York where thousands showed up, or up in Albany where thousands showed up. This isn't going away, and we're not allowing it to go away. I'm Gary Nall. Now to a larger issue, and this is short, and then we're going to take a break and come back, but this is very important. What was left of electoral politics? I'm sure many of you are now familiar that with the issue that today the U.S. Supreme Court not only sided with Citizens United, again, in a 5-4 decision, but codified it, even making it more emphatic, giving even corporate America and its deep pockets even more power to corrupt our system. Chris Hedges, the electoral politics in the United States gasped and sputtered to its extinction with the 2010 Supreme Court ruling known as Citizens United. At that point, the game simply was over. Legalized bribery now defines our entire political process at every level. The most retrograde elements of corporate capitalism, such as the Koch brothers, are the undisputed kingmakers. They won. They decide who gets elected by anonymously pouring hundreds of millions into campaigns. They hang with the super PACs like vultures over the heads of every federal and state legislator. Any politician who dares to challenge corporate demands and unregulated corporate capitalism knows they will be thrust from political life as well as their highly paid corporate jobs once they leave office. Politicians, including Barack Obama, are corporate employees, and they know it. Corporate money has corrupted the American political system, but even before the 2010 Citizens United ruling. We had 35,000 corporate lobbyists in Washington by 2010, writing legislation and funneling corporate donations to compliant politicians. But the ruling snuffed out even tepid and marginal resistance. It transformed us into an oligarch, corporate state. It marked, in essence, the culmination of the corporate coup d'etat that has slowly been established over the past few decades. We can identify our individuality through brands or choices in lifestyle, but political freedom simply does not exist. Our highly choreographed campaigns are bizarre spectacles, sterile and empty acts of political theater. The personal narrative of candidates is the central point of debate, not issues, not programs, not policies. The rhetoric and style is different. In short, the demands are brands that are different between Republican and Democrats, but the substance is the same. It is impossible within the political system of the United States to vote against the interest of Goldman Sachs or Exxon. Political debate is dominated by opinions rather than facts. Lies are true. The right-wing Heritage Foundation, for example, designed President Obama's health care bill. It was first put into practice by then-Governor Mitt Romney in 2006 in Massachusetts. Barack Obama adopted it after corporate lobbyists for the pharmaceutical and insurance industries rewrote it to include a $447 billion in subsidies exclusively to them. Obama signed on. RomneyCare is Obamacare. It forces consumers to buy a default corporate product. The insurance companies can raise co-payments and premiums, including for the elderly and those on fixed income. They are exempted from providing coverage to chronically ill children. And once you get sick, you can be priced out of the market. Of the 1 million Americans who go bankrupt every year because they cannot pay their medical bills, 80% are insured. This abuse will remain untouched. Thank you, President Obama. The healthy will pay. The sick will be pushed aside. The debate on the airwaves between Republicans and Democrats and shame the left, you are equally culpable on MSNBC and on these very airwaves because you failed to engage in real scholarship, instead ideologies. and it has blinded you to any truth except for your radicalized concepts of obedience to a political cause. Shame on you. Now before the Supreme Court, and having voted, this is the dumb show, the vast dumb show. And this is as true for every piece of legislation pushed through Congress. The corporate media exists not to illuminate, but to perpetuate the mirage. Coke versus Pepsi, take your pick, as if there's a difference. The capturing of the legislature, the executive and judicial, by corporate power, however, is the only one stage that we have not understood. It is the first stage. We now have entered the second. The corporate state led by Congress and the Supreme Court is rapidly criminalizing dissent. The National Defense Authorization Act, which was a bipartisan bill signed into law on New Year's Eve by Obama, permits the U.S. government to employ the military as domestic police force that can detain citizens accused of supporting any associated forces without due process until, in the language of the law, the end of hostilities, which may be a lifetime. Obama has employed the Espionage Act against government officials who have leaked information about war crimes to the press, virtually shutting down investigative reporting entirely. Only the official narrative now prevails. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Amendment Act, or FISA, retroactively made legal what under our Constitution was illegal. The warrantless wiretapping, monitoring, and eavesdropping on citizens is pervasive. It is all encompassing, and the Supreme Court utterly inverting the concept of the rule of law recently ruled that those who are strip searched by police or corrections officers, even if they are innocent of a crime, could not challenge the measures in a court of law. In short, there is no legal recourse to any abuse of power in the United States. Thank you, corporate Democrats. Thank you, corporate Republicans. You are responsible. The corporations will disembowel, or in the language of business school, they will harvest what is left of the country. The security and surveillance apparatus will lock up those who resist. This is the future. The iron circle will shut tight. Doubt me? Do so, but show me wrong. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment, that with Chris Hedges.
Today I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I am Gary Nall. Let's say hello to Sybil Edmonds, E-D-M-O-N-D-S. She is the former FBI translator who gained notoriety for having exposed illicit activities within the FBI involving security breaches, intelligence neglect about pre-9/11 communications. Nice to have you with us today, Sybil.
Thank you for inviting me, Gary.
I'm going to ask you a few questions. Keep quiet and let you tell us a story, all right?
Sure.
You have information about 9/11 that many of us would consider was essential because it could represent, could, and you will fill in the information to tell us whether or not it is, that this could have been in part a false flag operation, because information was being shared that you had privy to, that you had translated, showing that other individuals within intelligence and diplomatic services were telling us that there were going to be plane attacks on in cities, on buildings, and that information was known and given to higher-ups within the FBI, and yet you and others who had this information were told that was not going to be the case. No one was going to know about this and shut it down. Is that correct or not?
Yes, this applies to at least three, four specific cases of intelligence gathered, but later intentionally blocked by the higher-ups and, most importantly, by the outside agencies that pressured the FBI not to pursue certain lead investigations. And those two agencies are, in particular, State Department and the CIA.
Then tell us the story. Tell us now the story that Americans have not heard, the media has not reported, and was never allowed before the 9/11 commission into the official story. Because if you can explain to us and prove that what you're saying is correct, then we must take a completely different look at everything involving 9/11 and the complicity of the FBI, the White House, the State Department in having knowledge and not acting on it. The forum is yours.
Well, a couple of things first, Gary. One, it's not only 9/11, but also other ongoing criminal activities by our politicians, both elected and appointed government individuals. And the second thing is there already was a report by the Inspector General's office, and this was pretty unusual. Even though this Inspector General's office for the Justice Department classified 90% of its report, they made the conclusion public. That's the only portion they made public in my case. And this was after 4 years of looking into my case and interviewing witnesses and looking at the documents I took to them. And they said, all my reports and allegations to Congress and to them were confirmed, and they were all supported by other witnesses, official documents. So this doesn't deal with allegations, somebody coming out of an agency and saying a bunch of things, saying, well, this and that, and I say so. At the same time, even though later they got intimidated in the Congress, two senators' offices began investigating my case in 2002 from both parties, one Republican, Senator Grassley, the other one Democrat, Senator Leahy, and they came out publicly, and again, these are all part of the public records, and they said they interviewed people within the FBI, and they confirmed my reports and allegations. So at this point, it goes beyond that. And in terms of summarizing it, well, it took 358 pages, this book, Classified Woman, that I just released, which the government says not a single word of it can be published, to tell the story to the American people, because the mainstream media for 8-10 years just blacked out this story. And even when they covered it, I mean, and this is by, you know, major media outlets like Washington Post and New York Times and CNN, they tried to make the story to be about some poor whistleblower being fired wrongfully from the FBI for blowing the whistle. They never covered, and this is the U.S. media, what were those reports that led all these, you know, to all these actions by the FBI. The ACLU declared me the most classified woman in the United States history. There has never been a case where a person has been slapped with so many gag orders and invocation of state secrets privilege. So when people look at this and say, well, why? Why would the government, the United States government, go to such a degree and slap all these gag orders and state secrets privilege? What is it that they are trying to cover up? That should be the natural question arising from my case, right?
Yes, but tell us what they covered up. Tell us what they're terrified of you being on the show today and telling our audience. Tell us the truth.
Well, as I said, with the limited time, it is very difficult to cover everything, but I will give you highlights. Again, it took 358 pages.
Okay, but give us the highlights now.
Well, one of the things that they have been trying to cover up dealt with the counterintelligence files and the operations I was working for with these agents involving several foreign countries, also dealt with U.S. persons. And U.S. people, these U.S. persons were also targets of investigations. Well, these were the highest level people in U.S. We had, at the time, the Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, who was under FBI investigation since 1996. FBI had boxes of files on Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert on criminal activities ranging from espionage related to other criminal activities that involve narcotics operations in Chicago. But the FBI was being prevented from pursuing it and making it into a criminal case in court by the political factors, the White House, and also by the State Department and the CIA, because some of these briberies and espionage-related activities dealt with these ally countries that buy every year billions of dollars of worth of weapons from us. Some of them are NATO allies. So they wanted this to be wrapped. And as a result of that, individuals, there were at least 13 congressional people. And these people were engaged in treasonous activities, criminal and treasonous. Well, these were covered up for years, despite the fact that the agents, the FBI agents, were trying to turn this into court cases and get these individuals indicted. Or another case dealt with individuals in the State Department. So this case involved espionage activities by high-level U.S. officials, also 9/11-related information being intentionally covered up. And as I said, these were supported by documents by several FBI agents and analysts, and it didn't even make it to that quasi-commission they put in place, 9/11 commission. Even though those individuals from the FBI, these high-level senior agents, some of these people send these documents, actually they went to the commission, they were blacked out. It didn't make it into the report.
Do you have
Go
ahead, please.
The most outrageous thing about this entire case, in addition to the cover up and what were being covered up, and to this day, there's still a lot of those are covered up, is the state of our nation, and that is I'm a U.S. citizen, and I am not a suspect terrorist. The United States government invoked the state secrets privilege in my case twice during George Bush administration. John Ashcroft invoked it once in 2002 and once again in 2004 when 9/11 family members, they deposed me in court to go and testify. So they came and they slammed them with the state secrets privilege saying Sybel Edmonds' case, the entire case, is covered by state secrets privilege. Therefore, she cannot testify in court. And they basically blocked all the court process in my case. Then they went as far as, and this again in 2004, John Ashcroft, they went and they issued an illegal gag order on Congress. I mean, it's illegal because we have this notion that says under Constitution separation of powers. The executive branch can't gag the United States Congress. But here is the pathetic part, Gary. The United States Congress, they abided by this illegal order.
Okay, I need you to answer a few questions to help the audience understand why there was such an insistence on going after you. Is it true that a French translator named Mariana informed you that in late June 2001, French intelligence had contacted the FBI with a warning of the upcoming attacks by airplanes? The French even provided names of the suspects. The translator had been sent to France, and her report was found to be accurate, and it was given to both the White House and the FBI headquarters. Is that true or not?
July, August 2001, she, together with two agents, because she was the language specialist translators, with two counterterrorism agents, they actually went to France, and they were fully briefed for close to 4 days by the French intelligence on all this specific information. They came, they wrote up their reports, they gave it to the FBI headquarters, and this report was included in White House briefing, because they have the intelligence briefing weekly for the White House, and these are the intelligence agencies such as the FBI and the CIA, and nothing happened.
Okay, is it also true that Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, and Mark Grossman, all in the neocon inner circle, were made aware of, were complicit in some way, of preventing information from getting out to the media and the mainstream public?
Yes, in this case, this mostly dealt with the operations carried out against the United States interests by individuals, the ones you named, Douglas Feith and Richard Perle, but also Mark Grossman in the State Department, and they were engaged with a criminal ring, and these were the foreign criminal rings. Some of them were from Turkey, and they were some individuals from Pakistan. These were diplomatic, with diplomatic covers. And they were actually providing information and facilitating illegal criminal activities by these organizations, the criminal organizations,
okay, so
in and outside the United States, which were absolutely against the United States' interests.
Including the transfer of state secrets involving nuclear as well?
Yes, and these included several Air Force nuclear weapons facilities, in addition to the large ones that we know, such as Los Alamos.
Okay.
I mean, we have had scientists there.
Second. I just want to say that we're going to say goodbye to those who listen to a 55-minute version of the program, but those who want to continue listening to this conversation can listen over the telephone by calling 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or just listen online at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Now, so what you're saying is that there was all forms of criminal activity going on that you were able to determine that the FBI did not want to get out. But I'm particularly interested, we won't go into the others. I'll save a whole hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour for you on those others. But what can you tell us very specifically about what else was known and who knew it, that attacks were coming and attacks by airplanes, and who they were, who the suspects were? All of this you were able to find out in your position of translating tapes and materials at the FBI, and how they did not want this to get out. And we would have to ask why, because if we found out that the White House, the CIA, the FBI all had information from multiple sources that there were attacks imminent, who was involved, and these were credible, and then they would all be complicit today in allowing this to have happened. So tell us what you know. Be a specific. Use names and specifics on this.
Well, as I said, Gary, it took 358 pages to tell the story from the beginning to the end with all the supporting, you know, witnesses, names, etc. I mean, it's really hard to have everything done without the context. And that ends up falling into the same approach by the mainstream media, just putting out sound bites out there and not provide the proper context for the information given. So many Americans, unfortunately, are so used to just going by sound bites without understanding in depth of what is happening. So I really have to break your question into several parts, but before any of that, we need to talk about the context of, first, what this book is about, Classified Woman, and why the government has been fighting its release, even though it's now released and is out there. But secondly, why those issues were covered up, and not by the FBI. You know, FBI is an organization, it's a little pawn under the much bigger establishment that actually rules this nation and globally. So to say that FBI had a reason to cover these issues up, if it comes to some bureaucratic bungling, yes, that would be absolutely true. But to actually cover up these horrendously big criminal activities and 9/11-related information, FBI doesn't have any reason. I mean, then people, they say, FBI, what is the FBI? Is it the building? Is it like this guy Mueller and before him, you know, Louis Freeh? No. You have to look at it and say, who are the interested parties, the top tier, the top layer people? And these are not the head of the CIA or the FBI. I mean, you have to look at what it is. And what it boils down to basically is the military-industrial complex, the big corporations, the oil companies. And then the question will become, well, why would they have this interest of getting this covered up? And that's when we start getting close to the truth by seeing the context, by seeing the macro layers here, rather than these very small individuals. In the past 10 years on 9/11, we, again, have had so many of these reports, oh, well, CIA knew this, or FBI had this. All it does, approaching it, you know, with this kind of an approach, what we are doing is we are actually taking the focus and attention away from the big picture, and we are putting these little micro, tiny little pictures there and getting people occupied with that instead of looking at the larger picture to see why the things are so wrong around us. And that links like I was listening to you when you were talking before you started interviewing me, when you were talking about the, well, let's say with this whole fracking and the poisoning of our water system, which I have been covering it in our news website, Boiling Frogs Post, well, you really have to look at the same mechanism behind all of these because they're all connected. They are not isolated incidents saying, okay, that's an FBI-related problem. The other ones are caused by the CIA guys. This is caused by this pharma industry on the healthcare. But when you look at it from the top there, you will get to the same people that you were talking about, Gary, and that is those big mega corporations and their global interests, which is not the same as the people's interest, whether it's us or other people around the world who are the victims of these global pursuits.
All right. What we will do, since we're out of time, I will set aside a full hour so that you can take us through the process that you experienced, and so we can know more about not just 9/11, but other crimes that you've uncovered that were never prosecuted, and the efforts, we now understand the efforts they made to silence you. They have done this with other whistleblowers. You are but one of many who have met the same fate, and it doesn't matter which agency. It's if you have something that can embarrass a bureaucracy, a bureaucrat, a corporation that's powerful and connected, it's pretty much going to be the same challenge. But I am looking forward to that discussion. I know people in the audience are, and I wish you well in telling your story and the courage to tell it. And the book is called Classified Woman, the Sybil Edmonds story, and the website is boilingfrogpost.com. We look forward to our next discussion.
Thank you, Gary.
All right. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I thank you all for taking your time to listen. We'll do, maybe next Monday, we'll do a whole hour with her. Interesting, because last night I did 3 hours on false flag operations. Now, stay tuned for Honesty Without Fear, the Whistleblowers Radio Hour. Please stay with us.